Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm a...
Michael Hohmeyer back with us. It's time for It's the Law. Hey, Michael, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Michael Ray. Glad to be with you as always.
Oh, and by the way, I'm looking at something right now, and this is something I wanted to get into. Because of politics and of the way things look like they're going, and you really have to get underneath certain things to realize the what of what's happening. I want to give you a quote from... Attorney General Holder. And the quote is, whites can't be victims of racial injustice because they haven't suffered enough. That was an incident in North Carolina within the last week, came out of the Peoria news, etc. And there was a couple of kids attacked. There's been black gangs, 60, 70 apiece, running through white neighborhoods, yelling that whites should die and threatening people and so on and so forth. And then Holder comes up with this particular statement. I think the problem here basically is this, that they're capitalizing on what was. And the problem with that is it's causing such a tremendous divide between the races that I haven't seen it this bad for as long as I can remember. And I go back a few years now. And when it comes down to it, they should be looking to heal these things, not helping the divide.
Well, unfortunately, this group of people, as long as they remain in power, are going to continue doing this kind of stuff. It doesn't surprise anybody. It's just a more egregious version of what we've come to expect from the left over the last 20, 30, 40 years. And it's reflected as much in the economic situation we're in as it is in the social, racial, cultural situation that we find ourselves in. As long as you have a group in power, these elites who go around saying this is our worldview, and we allow those people to remain in power, we're going to have to continue to suffer this outrageous cherry picking of who the winners are and who the losers are. And by the way, of course, you know, the losers always turn out to be the regular Americans, regardless of race, ethnicity, culture, etc. But just the regular folks are the ones who lose out, never the elites and their pets. The only way to fix it is to, return the government to people who will truly represent the voters. Hopefully that'll happen next year.
Well, absolutely. You know, I've got a kind of an interesting thought, a projection to see what happens. I really believe that we may see a woman in the presidential office, and there's a reason for that. That obviously a white man is going to have a hard time because if anybody who votes against Obama obviously is prejudiced, and we know the story and so on and so forth. They've used that card, that race card, so often now. But a woman, you can't put a woman in that same position. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens because a woman is not going to be hit with the same thing that the men are going to be hit with. Now, obviously, the smears and the campaigns and the rest of it are going on. The presidential candidate, Michelle Bachmann, the problem there is they're starting to call her smelly and stupid. The woman is an attorney. She is sophisticated. She is a tax attorney. And also, if you've seen her, she's as neat as you can possibly be. But it's the smear campaigns that are starting. My sister sits down with these posts all day, and there's some interesting things that come through. But these are the kind of things that are going on today that instead of saying this one is better than that one, we talk about how bad somebody is. And it's set up, it's intentional, and they're purposeful with the whole thing.
It is indeed. It is also a sign of how intellectually bankrupt the left is now, that they cannot do anything more than resort to name-calling. They can no longer compete on the battlefield of ideas. They just can't. Every state that practices what the left preaches is going insolvent. And it's very apparent in states like mine here in California, where they have invented mythological savings and mythological sources of money on which they say they have balanced the state budget based on $11 or $12 billion of money that's going to magically appear.
Sure.
You know, the feds can't do that. So on the other hand, they can print money. That's the way they've been sustaining themselves. But basically what it means is they're financially and economically bankrupt, and therefore the only way they can compete politically is by throwing mud. And you're right, they have a special hatred for women and minorities who are conservative. I think you would see the same thing in a slightly different variety, but the same idea, personal bashing going against Herman Cain, were he to be viewed as a legitimate or serious conservative candidate for the Republican
sure.
nomination. I don't think he is yet, and he's not getting a lot of opprobrium that way, although I think you can find quite a bit that he's gotten already, as small, I think, 10% support he has in Iowa in the latest poll. But certainly the women who appear to be legitimate major candidates like Palin and Bachman, as soon as they are identified as that, it's the politics of personal destruction. That's all the left has left.
Yeah, and when you really come down to it, I don't think Sarah Palin's going to run, and I think one of the reasons that she won't run, and she's smart enough to realize it's not her time yet, maybe in 4 years from now, and if she's very smart about it, which she is a smart woman, there's no question about that. But I'm looking at Michelle Bachman, and I'm thinking that all of those things that I had mentioned early on will cause her to get people to vote for her. We're looking at an election that's going to come up, and Obama is trying his hardest, there's no question, but we're looking at an election that's going to come up that there are people who will vote Republican or Independent or Tea Party just to get that man out of office. That's a sad state of affairs.
It is a sad state of affairs, but considering how all-important this election is, I'm happy to accept votes. Even if the vote is to throw the current bum out rather than a vote for a particular replacement. If that's what it takes to get this crowd turned out, that's what's necessary. It's not ideal, but second best is better than failure. And I'm happy to take them. I don't know that there may be an advantage to the Republicans having a female presidential candidate, although I believe the vast majority of people who would vote for the Republican candidate or the anti-Obama candidate, if you will, the opponent to Obama, I believe the vast majority of those people don't care whether the person's woman or a man or black or Hispanic or Asian or white or whatever. They say the stakes now are so high, that doesn't matter. We want this crowd out, and we want some common sense people brought back in. And, gee, is Michelle Bachman a woman? That's not really what's motivating most people.
No. And by the way, I happen to like a lot of the things that she said, but I want to go back to some of the things that Obama has done. You know, you look at these issues like, what did I hear him say just a moment ago, that it's all but over with as far as the gay marriage thing and so on and so forth. This is what I see, Michael, underneath this, not for or against gay marriage. That's not where I'm at with this. But if you want, and you've heard me probably a million times say this, and I'll say it again, we are the most powerful force in the world. You can't stand up toe-to-toe to us and win. We're too powerful for that. But if you want to beat us, you cause us to implode. And one of the ways that you cause us to implode is you divide us and conquer us. And I am watching some of the programs that Obama is behind in putting into actuality, putting into service, putting life to them. And all the programs are doing is dividing, 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 dividing. And it's almost not the issue itself. It's the motivating force underneath the issue, which is driving an ideology that's going to cause this country to fall down.
I understand exactly what you're talking about. It's an extremely dangerous way of retaining political power. But again, I believe the left has no choice. That's all that progressivism can stand on now, and that is creating a house divided against itself. And you continue to see the sops being tossed to every special interest group they have that they can think of. You see it not only in the gay marriage issue, but you'll see it in things like the withdrawal of forces out of Afghanistan. I think there are very few commentators, even on the left, who don't see this for what it is. It's a bald political calculation, and the intent is, regardless of the strategic implications, to bolster the president's reelection prospect by attempting to throw a sop to the left, the anti-war left, for whom this is a major issue. If you want to keep those people donating money, if you want to keep them agitated and calling their neighbors to go out and vote, you've got to give them a bone. This is their bone, and it is so obvious what it is, not only the timing issue, but the fact that the administration is being caught lying about it when they say that the president's decision was to withdraw the troops was merely one of a list of options that the military presented him with, when in fact the military has said in sworn testimony before Congress yesterday or today that no, what the president chose was never one of the options that the military presented him with. So they're attempting to get cover by saying, oh, we are doing a military option, when in fact it's not. And why are they lying? Because they know they need to cover themselves while they're throwing that sop to one of their special interest groups. We need to expose it for what it is, and hopefully by exposing it, that will encourage yet another group of perhaps undecided or independent folks to say, you know what, enough already. We're going to join the anybody but reelect Obama in 2012.
Two things. The first thing is I would not have wanted to have been in the White House in the morning yesterday. And I'm not sure if you heard the news about Israel, but they just discovered oil. And there's enough reserves that they've discovered that will be as much, if not more, than Saudi Arabia.
I have to tell you, I did hear those reports, and I must say, I can only pray that they be true. And
yeah,
there would be nothing, I think, that most Americans might actually agree upon, that they would love to see OPEC and those folks, their stranglehold on the world economies because of their oil monopoly, broken. Another way to break their monopoly, though, I have to say, would be not just relying on Israeli sources of oil or oil from sources of friendly countries, but our own. You know, there have been so much discoveries of how much amazing reserves of natural gas, amazing reserves of oil derived from shale sands that can be extracted if only the United States would get back to the business of exploring and drilling and recovering our own oil and gas assets. We wouldn't have to rely on just Israel, and we could break this cartel tomorrow.
We will.
The Israeli discovery will be borne out, and there will be an alternative to OPEC that will soften their control, or maybe even one day, if added to our own exploration and drilling, which hopefully will happen when a new administration comes in, a conservative administration in 2012 to replace these guys, that we will see that the stranglehold of OPEC can once and for all be broken. So let's hope that news you're reporting about is accurate. That would be a godsend.
And by the way, very interesting, if we really think about it, and through all of your experience, the research, the study that you've done, the capacity that you use your professional ability with, here's my question to you, is there anything that this country can't produce on its own that it needs to go outside for? Is there anything at all that we can't create right here if we had, you said it, the will and the desire to do so?
Well, you know, the practical answer is, of course, there must be some ore deposit or some mineral or some element that may not, by some fate, happenstance, occurrence when the Earth was created, not be located within the United States.
Yeah.
But as far as creating alternatives to those resources that we don't actually have and can't get from friendly sources, I think if given enough motivation and incentive, I think the American imagination is limitless, And one day we will come up with a practical electric car. One day we will come up with a lot of these green technologies that many of my clients are trying to make economically make sense in order to have them be real alternatives in the, to achieve reasonable green and sustainable goals, not ridiculous environmental wacko goals, but realistic ones that we could all support. I believe that there's no limit to what Americans can invent because we have so such a premium on freedom and liberty when the government will just get out of people's way. I believe that you're right. I believe that there's nothing we couldn't come up with eventually. Enough progress, enough technology, enough investment, enough incentivizing. I agree with you. I think there's nothing that we can't come up with even to replace something we may not even have yet.
Absolutely. The answers, the solutions are right here. And if we had the ability, and I have to say the ability because you can't do it without without moving through some type of governmental regulation. We have it here. It's been here. It will always be here. I came up on something about a week ago. Let me do this real quick. 64 years ago, Norman Thomas knew what was going to happen in our country in 2009. Norman Mattoon Thomas, November 20th, 1884 to December 19th, 1968, was a leading American socialist, a pacifist, with six times presidential candidate for the Socialist Party of America. The Socialist Party candidate for president of the United States, Norman Thomas, said, and he said this in a 1944 speech, "The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt the very fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without knowing what happened." And he went on to say, I no longer need to run as a presidential candidate for the Socialist Party. The Democratic Party has adopted the platform.
And that was, 65 years ago. And I imagine he'd probably be quite proud of his prediction today because apparently it looks like we're already there, given what has happened over the last 2.5 years and where this administration says it wants to take the country.
Sure.
I am hoping, Michael Ray, that 3 years from now we'll be looking back and saying he would not be feeling that way were he still alive in 3 years in the future. Hopefully the election next year will turn this crowd out. Common sense and a return to first principles will be the order of the day. And what I believe will happen, if people will vote for that return, we'll have a rebirth and a re-renaissance of America. We will this recession will end. We'll put people back to work. And the future that we all believed in as Americans up until about 3 or 4 years ago, it's still out there. We'll claim it anew for ourselves and our children and grandchildren if we make that change next year. It's not too late to say to that man, were he able to come back down and look around, you're wrong. You were wrong, you are wrong, and you will always be wrong. And that's assuming, again, he would be resurrected in 2013 rather than 2011.
Now, we have to close it up, Michael, but I want to close it up with this. I think the biggest confusion that most people have is basically this. It's not the Republicans or the Democrats. I mean, I'm right to center, but my goodness, there's a tremendous amount of things that that the Democratic Party believe in that I also believe in. There's both sides of the street for the average person. But the main concern is this. It's not they talk Republican, they talk Democrat. That's not who they're talking about. They're talking about the extreme on both sides. And the extreme on both sides gets me to draw back. You hear it.
Yes, I do. And a lot of people feel the same way. Look, the Tea Party, which is nominally conservative on an economic basis, exists because the Republicans didn't satisfy the people's demand for common sense economics either. The Republicans have their share of elites, people who go along to get along in Washington, D.C., and people are unhappy with the Republicans, too. And we've talked, Michael Ray, last year's change in the balance of power was not to permanently support the Republican Party. It was to give them a chance. If they blow it, then the Republican Party will be consigned to the same dustbin that will ultimately collect the Democrat Party.
Absolutely. Michael, we're running out of time, but I want to leave it with this particular comment. When they talk about Republicans, I've heard of, baby killers. They want to kill the old people. They want to kill whatever. And they don't believe in freedom of speech and freedom. But then I want to leave it with this. Martin Luther King was a Republican.
Yes, and he would be today.
Absolutely. By the way, can we get your website before we go?
www.homeierlaw.com, spelled H-O-M-E-I-E-R-L-A-W.com.
Hey, Michael Homeier. See you next week.
Great talking with you. Talk to you then.
Good night.
Good night.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
And Chris, I hope I get this right. Chris Hillier is the author of 27 Powers of Persuasion, Simple Strategies to Seduce Audiences and Win Allies. Chris is an award-winning consultant who's developed communication strategies for more than 20 years now. In 2007, his firm, Jury Impact, was recognized at the American Business Awards as one of the nation's most innovative companies. He's provided legal and political commentary for USA Today, Fox News, and on a national news broadcast for NBC and C-SPAN. Again, he's the author of 27 Powers of Persuasion, a simple strategies guide to communication and persuasion. Chris, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, Chris, how do you pronounce your last name? I'm sure I probably didn't do it right.
Well, you know, it's Saint Hilaire, but you're not the first one to convince a saint didn't belong there.
Okay, Saint Hilaire. 27 Powers of Persuasion. Chris, let's start out with what is persuasion? I mean, it's a good word, but most people take that word and they feel like somebody's being pushed into something that they don't want to do, say, etc. So let's start out with defining what persuasion is.
Yeah, and it's a great point. Persuasion in America gets a bad rap. I think it's confused with manipulation. It's confused with cajoling or tricking someone. And so,
yeah.
Actually, when I was doing my research for the book, I did focus groups just on the issue of persuasion, and people confused persuasion with door-to-door salesmen and dirty tricks. And really, that's not what persuasion is. Good persuasion, true persuasion, is the building of consensus from conflict or no idea at all, and getting people marching the same direction as, you know, half of life's battle.
Yeah. Now, and by the way, I completely and totally agree with that. And we talk about persuasion. Persuasion can be as simple as getting close to a friend, getting close to somebody, and allowing them to see that what you have is going to benefit them way in some way, shape, or form. But besides the emotional impact of persuasion, there's also physical gestures, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, touch can be one of the best forms of persuasion. And, you know, I'd challenge your listeners to try this either now or sometime in the near future. When two people are trying to make a point, try touching someone else's arm. You know, just put your hand on theirs, and the power and the impact of touch will actually get people listening to you, and it'll quietly silence them. There's no underestimating the power of touch.
Now, by the way, when it comes to persuasion, where was it, Chris, for you? Where was it that it set that light bulb on and you decided that this is what you wanted to get into because you saw something that people didn't see?
Yeah, and I think we all persuade in our own ways. For me, you know, I thought that I was majoring in communication and persuasion in college because it didn't have any math in the curriculum other than the basic statistics. But you know, as I think back and as I wrote the book, you know, some stories from my childhood came back, and In fact, I watched how poorly my parents communicated. They're now divorced, and they were both good parents. But I'd watch the way that they'd use language, and even as a 10-year-old, it struck me that they're repeating back negatives. And if they just use some very simple tactics that a 10-year-old could figure out, that are so easy to miss, I think, when you're too involved or too emotionally involved in a situation, they would have communicated much, much more clearly.
Communication is a very interesting thing, and most people think that they're communicating when they're talking, and there's a rule that I learned many years ago, and that rule is talking is not communication. It's not what you say, it's what that other person hears. And most importantly, in a lot of communication back and forth, whether it be professional or a couple of people talking, most of the time, the message that you're trying to give somebody is not the message they receive. Just to play with it for a minute, if you want to break a word down, you got the definition of the word, which is the meaning. You got the connotation of the word, which is meaning plus the emotional impact. You got the verbal content, which is face value. The nonverbal content, which is the underlying meaning. And let's add this one. This is a big one to the mix. The state of mind of the receiver. You walk into the room. You look at your wife. You say, boy, and she's in a good mood. You say, you're looking great. And she says, thank you. You walk in. She's in a bad mood. You say, you're looking great. And she says, what do you mean by that?
Well, I've been married 12 years now, so I can relate all too closely. But, you know, what you're saying really is perception is reality. And,
sure.
And it's not what you're saying, it's what they're hearing that counts. And so you have to understand your audience and their backgrounds and perspectives. So, you know, when I use the term welfare, I can tell you that most of the American public, somewhere around 74% of Americans, oppose it. But when I use the term social safety net, that same number supports it. Now, you tell me the difference. The difference is the perception that the word creates. And so understanding your listeners, their biases, their backgrounds, and what it is they're hearing, and then putting it in language that's going to open them up to, one, being persuaded, but two, eventually then agreeing and coming with you in that persuasion is the fundamental key to communication.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it, because when you really come down to it, there's a universal language that will reach any audience, because there's a biology. There's a natural science behind the use of your words. Your words actually stimulate reactions in the emotional part of your brain, because every word you speak sends an image or a picture to that unconscious mind. Every time you hear a word, the word in turn generates a matching mental picture. And you could do something like this. If I were to say to you, automobile, one word. What kind of an automobile do you see in your mind if I say automobile?
And you're asking me?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
Yeah, I see the car I own. So.
Okay, but you see a color and a style and everything, right?
And absolutely.
I've used that example for the last couple of months, and what keeps coming up for me when I say that is the very first car that I ever owned, which was a 1950 Studebaker. It was blue, and it had a bullet point front. Okay. But the message here is really interesting, because with one word, we see two distinctly different images. And when somebody's presenting and persuading to make sure that everybody sees the same thing, the same image when you say something, and most people don't know how to do that.
Yeah, and absolutely. And you're talking about a couple of things. One, the importance of emotional language. So when we're in a courtroom, for example, and we're trying to talk about, you know, a 1-pound premature child, you know, saying this child weighed about the amount of a stick of butter, it really creates an image of the complexity of the situation that those caregivers are dealing with. It
Sure.
creates context. And so understanding that context and using emotional language in a way that's going to create an image, the image that benefits you in your listener's mind, is really important.
Oh, no question about it, because when it really comes down to it, based on our past experiences, we have these completely different images from one another, and to get it into our frame of reference is really tough for people. And one of the ways that I've learned to do that over the years is an appropriate story, because they'll see themselves, they'll feel themselves when they recognize something about themselves in the story. And then all of a sudden you've got an entire audience. It could be a million people on the same page of what you mean by what you say.
Well, and how do you create that context that allies you with your listener? And some simple strategies. I talk to people about the three most powerful words in the English language, which are choice, fairness, and accountability. So, you know, if my goal is to preserve choices, to ensure fairness, and hold everybody accountable, I can transition to anything else after that. I win.
Sure.
That creates context, and that allies you with people. So always seeking fairness in conversations gets you to some agreement point and some basis by which to start the conversation.
You know who does this brilliantly, and I'm not that much of a fan, but the you got to give him his due, Obama. If you really listen to the structure of his presentations, of his talks, the structure, he'll pause, and then he'll make a statement. He'll pause again, and then he'll come up with a rhetorical story. The first pause is an unconscious alert something's coming. Then he makes a literal left-brain statement, the healthcare's in shambles. Then he pauses again. The pause after the statement is critical because most people get to that point they want to emphasize and they gloss over it. People miss it. But that pause allows people to absorb what just got said and then moving to a rhetorical story. Bill from Texas lost his job, lost his health care. Now his daughter needs to go to the hospital and he doesn't have any money. That hits the emotion, that 80% emotional part of your audience, and they also realize at that point that he intimately understands their concerns. That in and of itself, I think, has got to be some of the most powerful tools of persuasion that anybody can use.
Well, and you know, the good news, I'm on the other side of the aisle and don't like the direction that Obama's taking us. But
by the way, we're on the same side of the aisle.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm on the other side of the aisle of Obama.
Oh, you're on his side.
I'm not on his side. I don't like where President Obama is taking America, but I watch the way the context of communication and the way he builds it, he gets people opened up to being persuaded. Now, you know, fundamentally, human beings are, you know, we're our own creatures, and we make our own decisions in the end, but he gets heard, and he does that through a lot of the context of communication and a lot of the tools that we use in my book. I listen to him use the words fairness and choice and accountability, and I watch, you know, some of his examples. Now, fortunately, the American public is seeing through a lot of what it is he's done, but in terms of getting them to listen and building that context, he does a brilliant job of it.
Oh, sure. And by the way, we are both on the same side of the aisle. I'm center right, so I'm there. But the point of contention is you know, he was brilliant in what he did, and look at the votes that he got in. He used an internet like nobody else used it. Now everybody knows they'll use it. But point of contention, he's a great example of the power of persuasion.
Well, and they asked him, you know, it's in the examples in my book, are you for bigger government or smaller government? And his retort was, I'm for smarter government. Now, smarter to him didn't mean what smarter meant to your average American in Indiana or North Carolina or some of the other swing states. And so he was able to ally his interests through his words and getting people creating their own emotions and portraying on him what they wanted to believe government should be, when in fact, you know, he wanted to make the government bigger. His idea of smarter, he wasn't lying. What he thinks is smarter is more and bigger.
Yeah, and by the way, on power number 24, I've memorized your book, page 171, challenge bad ideas by challenging the details, just what you said.
Well, and that's a, you know, that's a pretty classic campaign trick. I've been in, gosh, hundreds of campaigns now over our time, and you know that you go in and you really need to look at the details when you're trying to oppose, because obviously sometimes there are details which can create problems for the promoters. And he wanted to talk concepts and philosophy and you know, hope and change. And when he put some context to that, I don't think the American public were in total agreement anymore.
Oh, no question about it. I think really when it comes down to it, the what you're teaching, what's in the book, it's got to be out there, because one of the most confusing things that we have today is communication. People are so confused with what they hear in the media that they're really not sure which way to go, because what they hear is the surface and they don't understand we don't understand the underlying meanings, which causes a tremendous amount of apathy. And if I could use that word every night, I would. The apathy causes us to move in the direction that's not the best for us. So the power of persuasion, understanding it, the old adage is you've got to be able to fight fire with fire. Don't take a knife to a gunfight.
somebody's going to persuade. I mean, the average American gets 6,000 requests for their attention every single day. So look at your T-shirt. There's a logo. Look at your shoes. There's a logo. Look on your coffee cup. Somebody wants your attention all of the time. And so we're getting self-imposed ADD in this society because we have to. We cannot process all the requests for attention. And so given the fact that somebody's going to persuade in this society, it might as well be the ones with the best ideas. And getting those ideas heard is more and more challenging. What's in this book are tools to get those ideas heard. Because, you know, persuasion is both an art and a craft. The art, the idea behind what it is you're promoting is always going to be yours, and I don't think it should ever be pinpointed completely. I think that's part of the creative genius of humanity. But that craft, those tools to get people to listen and give your opportunity the best chance to succeed, those can be learned in this book.
And by the way, life in and of itself is a process, and the process is what we learn through. And I'm looking at what you have. And I think what you've got is, you know, you're going to hit it out of the ballpark with this. And people in all walks of life should get a hold of this, because this is not just for politics or business. This is the same thing if you're coming home at night and being able to talk to a family.
Yeah, and, you know, being a first-time author, I have a very good, big publishing house. But, you know, I've been real well received by the media. And further, you know, it's been published in the UK and all of its countries. Around the world, and it'll be in Portuguese later this year. Now, I don't speak Portuguese, so if they mistranslate it, I'll never know. But I've got to feel good that the reception's been as warm as it has been.
Wonderful. By the way, we're starting to run out of time now. Chris, website we can find you at and buy your book.
Oh, sure. It's www.27powersofpersuasion.com. It's also available at Borders and Barnes & Noble, as well as Amazon online.
Wonderful. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for spending the time with us tonight.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Single day there, and once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Mandy Ziegler with us continues the work of her late husband, respected futurist and educator, Warren Ziegler, and she helps people to listen to their spirit voice and identify their spirit type. An engaging speaker, and Mandy is also the co-author with her late husband of the book, When Your Spirit Calls in Search of Your Spiritual Voice. Mandy, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being here. How many people miss that? How many people wouldn't understand or know what a spirit voice was if they heard it all day long?
Probably quite a few would not. In our society, we don't spend a lot of time learning our spiritual voice or actually paying attention to it. It's much easier as children before we are taught roles and labels and taught not to do things our spiritual expression is more open at that time. But I think you get to a certain age where you start wondering why you're here, what you're meant to be, what's the meaning of life. And that's possibly when you begin to invite your spirit back into your life.
Now, is the spirit voice the little voice inside of you that sometimes you pay attention to and sometimes you don't? What I think I found in my experience over the years, there's two voices. The one that's on top that says, you can't, you can't, you can't. And then the one underneath it that every once in a while when you let out says, yes, you can.
Yes, that is your spiritual voice, is the second one you're talking about. The first one has to do with your social biography. And that is how you're grown up, your background, your culture, your religion. These are stories that have been told to you about yourself. They are the knowledge that you have, your belief system, your value system, your attitudes, and your faith. That all makes up your social biography. It tells you what to do and how to live. It's very important, and it's a very important part of your life, of course, but you also have the spiritual side of your life. And that is your true self, your true essence. So there are two parts of you, and once you recognize and discover your spiritual side and what that means to you, the two of these need to work together.
No question.
In order to make right decisions about your life and which direction to go.
Now, most people, and it's a shame to say what I'm going to say next, but most people have to fall down and fall down hard before they'll wake up and realize that there's something more to them than this physicalness that they run around in. And I would venture to guess if somebody could just find out beforehand where they wouldn't have to go through all the stuff to get to the same place, would be wonderful.
Yeah, that's probably true. Most people go through experiences. Well, you have a life to live. So sometimes things are going to go along fine, and you're not going to be worried about any of this stuff. But most people have jolts. They have employment problems. They have health problems. They have relationship problems. And that's when they begin to start thinking more seriously about why they're here, what's the purpose of life, and can possibly then begin to change direction.
Yeah,
and learning your spiritual archetype, learning your spiritual voice, and who that is, and can help you do that.
Now, by the way, if I wanted to be led to my spiritual voice, my spiritual identity, what do I do to find out? How do I find out Michael Ray's spiritual identity?
There's a couple ways, and both are mentioned in the book. The first thing is to think about your gifts and talents, what those are. And these are things that you've had all of your life. Your gifts are things that you give away. Your talents are things that you are born with. A lot of times your family will recognize some of this talent that you know about. Sometimes your friends and family need to tell you what they are. I'm not talking about some great athletic skill or intellectual, musical skill. Everybody has talents. Everybody are born with certain skills, behavioral skills that they can identify with. Some people call this these days your genius. And to recognize and see those will help you realize what type of archetype. Now, my husband discovered that there were 9 archetypes, universal archetypes in the world. And the book is about discovering which one of those archetypes you are. And it goes through each description. And at the end of each description of the archetype, they have some very thought-provoking questions that you can ask and reflect upon to see if this, in fact, if you fit there. Most of them you're not. You read it, you say, that's not me, you go on to the next one. But there could be 2 or 3 where you just are kind of borderline and you're not sure, and the questions help you get more of a clear idea of what type of spiritual archetype or spiritual voice whatever you want to call it, your true being is.
Okay, now, I don't have the book, but let's play with me. Well, let's break me down, okay? The couple of questions that we have on the press release. One is, what were you meant to be? And also, is your present work your true calling? And I would have to give you a resounding yes for what I do. If I will never retire, I couldn't think of anything that I would want to do in addition to what I'm doing now.
You're very lucky because you have found that your spiritual voice expresses, or your work expresses your spiritual voice, your voice expresses your work. Most people don't find that. And that's not a terrible thing. I mean, people have to have a job. They have to survive. They have to earn a living. So a lot of times their work does not define their spiritual voice. Even by identifying what that voice is, you can use that knowledge in your work, even though you know that this type of work is not really what you were meant to do. Sometimes it's inevitable that you can't get out of it, or it might take you a few years to realize that you need to leave and start something else. But I think a lot of people are realizing that your work does not necessarily define who you are.
No, it's what you do.
Who you are involves all aspects of your life, not just your job. But
no question about it.
There are certain people that, like yourself, that have found that the two match, and that's very lucky.
No, absolutely. That this is a way of life, and I wouldn't want anything to change in any phase or facet of the process of doing so. Communication and radio have been what I've been about for probably 35, 40 years now. And by the way, I started when I was 2. How was that? I was just tall at the time. but that's really
what it is.
That's
a good age to start because you pretty much kind of listen to your spiritual voice at that age.
Yeah, I just walked into it. Now, but the big question here is this. Oh, by the way, one other thing. Somebody once said to me, when are you going to retire? And I said, "What? Retire from what? And they said, work. I said, I don't work.
Well, that's a good answer.
But it's true also. Okay, so how do we find out what kind of a spirit I am?
What kind of a spirit? Again, you go through the book. It describes each type of spirit, each type of spiritual archetype. And by reading the descriptions, you can more or less identify who you are by answering, by looking and responding to the questions at the end of each description.
Okay, now let me ask you a question.
The questions help you reflect on experiences that you've had in the past, your childhood. It helps you go back into memories to see if you have indeed experienced certain things in your life that possibly identify with this spiritual type.
Okay, let's do this. Now, how many archetypes are there?
There are 9.
Okay, let's go to number 8. Let's just try one out just to get a feel of what it's like. Let's go to number 8 and see what we have. Okay. I don't have the book in front of me, so
I'm actually not sure which one number 8 is. Let's try the mending archetype, okay? Let's just try that because I'm not sure.
What number is that?
I have these in order.
It's okay.
A mending archetype. Now, let me explain that an archetype is an ideal type. It doesn't mean that these other archetypes are not cannot be a part of your life. A mending archetype is someone that focuses on bringing people together. If they're in a conflict or they're having a problem, a person like this helps to try to solve the problem. Bring people together by helping understand what is underneath the conflict, by kind of putting pieces together, the fragmented pieces that they have together. I equate it sometimes to making a quilt. A quilt, you have all kinds of different sizes of material, designs, different types of fabric. You have frayed edges that you cut off and try to sew back together. So you can throw pieces out and bring pieces back in and try to make it fit together. And a mending spirit kind of does that with conflicts and helping people put their lives back together again when there's a problem. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're not a mending spirit that you can't help somebody have a better day.
What I heard you say is that these aren't what you're dealing with is 100% extremes, and we're all
agree
with both.
I'm not trying to put everybody into certain little categories. That's not what these archetypes are. It's just that you have a stronger, your spirit is strong in this area. And if you recognize that you're a mending spirit, it can help you in your family relationships, in your coworker and your work relationships, even as strangers, by recognizing that this is how you deal with life, it can move you forward in a more positive way.
Okay. By the way, what number was that one?
Well, again.
Or do you have it? It's okay.
I don't have it. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's all right. No, not a problem. Not a problem. And I really believe if somebody goes through and they begin to experience what those are, and then when you start to match them up, the biggest problem that we have today, and it comes down to one very simple thing, Mandy, we don't have our own identity. And mm-hmm. we look and we search. And
exactly.
We do this.
And I think that's what people are concerned about. Mm-hmm. That's one of our greatest needs is to find out the meaning of our lives, who we are, why are we here? What's the purpose? You know, you go through some frustrating experiences in your life, and you just think, is anything going to happen here? What am I supposed to do? It's also the most difficult to discover. And that's a life process that you go through. Discovering it. Your spirit never changes, but your life changes. There's nothing permanent in your life. I mean, everything changes except your spirit. Your spirit is the same.
Now, I think what most people make is they look for their spirituality outside of themselves. And it's not outside, it's inside. And when you begin to recognize who you
are. It's within yourself. It's what you were meant to be. It is what you cannot not be and cannot not do.
And there's where the problems in life occur when you resist what you're not.
Many ways you can describe this. Some people have vision. Some people have a gut feeling. Some people feel very calm when their spirit is around. But you have to be very accepting of this. You have to invite your spirit into your life, into your comfort zone, and learn to listen to it. Learn to listen for the signals.
Okay, now let me tell you what I'm hearing from you. What I'm hearing from you is basically this. If you connect with your spirit, things run smoothly. But when you're not connecting with your spirit and who you really are, life is one disaster after another until you get it.
Almost. Your life doesn't have to be a disaster. I mean, again, you have a social biography. You've grown up with certain part knowledge, belief systems, and that helps you with life. That takes you through experiences. So it isn't always a disaster. And your spirit kind of comes and goes. You know, it's just easier and happier if you can get the two together. They can bond together. When you're making big decisions, if you pay attention to both, because your spirit does have to live through your life experiences, your social biography. They have to work together. They have to create a bond or a dialogue together in order for you to flourish.
Yeah. No question about it. And also, it's allowing it to be. There was an old knock-knock that I heard years ago that stayed with me forever. And it went something like this. It went, knock-knock, suddenly came from within the soul. Who's there, asked the seeker, surprised and very frightened. It's God, came the voice from within. Prove it, said the seeker. And the silence returned.
Yeah. That's very good. Yeah, that's right. People need to recognize it, and they can call it what they want, you know, their essence, their basic goodness. It's whatever they want to call it. They don't have to call it a spirit, you know. There's a, I know a friend of mine, this was years ago, back in years ago, when was our last election? 2004, I guess. When
that was years
both
ago.
Sides, this was before the primaries, and both sides had all these people running, wanted to be nominated for president. Yeah. And a friend of mine, we were talking about all of this, and she said, you know, my background is telling me to vote for this person, but my spirit side is telling me to vote for that person. So I thought, well, that's very good. That just shows you that you can have some conflicts here.
Sure.
And making a decision as to which way to go, which involves your character. You know, certain decisions that you make involve character, which is another way of saying your spirit. So,
now, how long did it take you for the research for the book? And where'd you go to find out?
Warren actually did. And what he did, he worked with hundreds and hundreds of groups, workshops all over the world. And he taught people how to invent their own futures rather than accepting other people, you know, other people's future and what their future was going to be. So there's steps and practices that people went through to learn how to invent their future. And one of that was using your imagination. And he found that when people were imaging scenarios about their future, that they were using something much deeper inside of themselves. And these spiritual archetypes, he discovered, were coming out when people were describing scenes and descriptions of what their future, what they wanted their future to be. And he discovered nine of them, universal. One is no better than another. They're all equal, and they're all needed in the world. So he sat down and just listed them. This is what he discovered in people.
I hate to do this to you, Mandy, but we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you and the book at?
Yes, it's www.mandyziegler.com. And the book, When Your Spirit Calls, is by Warren Ziegler with Mandy Ziegler. It can be in any local bookstore. They can get it, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Kindle, and my website.
Yeah, and by the way, with the two voices, the top one and the bottom one, conscious, unconscious mind, usually when it happens to me, it happens at night. And when they're battling, they keep me awake. So I usually ask them to leave the room, come back in the morning when you got a good answer, and we'll sit down and discuss it.
That's an excellent idea.
Mandy, thank you so much. Thank you for
joining. Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Small. Say it's me that you adore. From now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each week, again, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called Solutions to You. Now, by the way, if there's a subject that you want addressed, if there's somebody you'd like to hear on the show, go to dresserafterdark.com, www. Get a hold of Radio Susie. She's right there. She's the blonde one. That's her. That's not me. And her email address is there. And request coming on the show as a guest. Termination Orders, code name Cobra. Leo Mahoney with us. The author spent over 35 years working in the most secretive and dangerous areas of law enforcement. And after leaving his career in Black Ops, Leo had the opportunity to try his hand at acting in independent films and TV commercials. He spent, he's done 10 movies. He's got them to his credit. And as an actor and behind the camera as a producer, technical advisor, and also an assistant director. And Leo, let's say hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. And thank you so much for being here. What an interesting transition from being in the Black Ops to movies. I guess it's all imagination, isn't it, when you really come down to it?
Yeah, that really is the truth. It's just wherever your imagination takes you, and you'd be surprised what you can do.
Oh, no question about it. Well, let me ask you this. The novel in and of itself, you know, the what is it? What's that takeaway? What's that message behind Codename Cobra?
Well, basically, it was written as a fiction, but based on my career in Black Ops, which started when I was a 19-year-old kid and took me up into my very early 50s. And it just, took me into a world that I was unfamiliar with and showed me what the world and the government was really about.
Is it scary? And when I say, is it scary, if the average person would be exposed to it without the training that you've had, obviously, do you think it would scare most people if they truly understand the way the world works, the way the government works, and what the end result of all of their actions are?
Yeah, I would say yes, it would. People really have no clue what really goes on within our own government. They're clueless, and most people would be in shock and probably couldn't handle the truth.
Yeah, and by the way, it doesn't even matter, Republican, Democrat, who's ever in office, because there seems to be this constant something that underlies the politics of the country, no matter which way it drifts between election to election, because it can't happen overnight. Those things that happen in government have been there for years and years and years and years, and for some reason, whatever reason that might be, the constituents, the population at large, aren't allowed to know this information.
That's totally true.
Now, Black Ops, how did you get into that? What caused you to be there in the first place?
Well, I was recruited during basic training in the Army. I had been entered the Army by way of the draft. And during my training, I was called in to meet at the captain's office. And I was recruited by two different gentlemen. And at first, they didn't tell me very much. We had just vague conversations. And this went on over a period of about a month. And then finally, I was brought in. I was given some specific testing. And it was then after the testing, they said that I had met a particular criteria they were looking for and basically asked me if I would be interested in serving the country in a different manner. And they told me what it was about. Being 19 years old, I absolutely loved the idea of it, and that's how it all started.
Okay, now, just out of curiosity, what time frame was that? What year was that? There's a reason I'm asking.
1966.
Okay, now, in 1966, and if you were to fast forward it 10 or 15 years, and you were that 19-year-old that walked into that same office, would you hear the same thing? Would what they wanted you to do, would it have been the same thing? Would it have been the same world you walked into with the training you had?
Basically, yes. There wouldn't have been much difference at all.
And even if you took you 10 years before that, same?
Before 66?
Yeah. If you would have been, let's say, 10, 15 years before 1966, if you would have been at the same office at the same time being interviewed by the same people, would you have walked into the same kind of, after saying yes, would you have walked into the same kind of life? Would things have been that much different? I'm trying to get a point across here.
It might have been a little more sophisticated later rather than earlier, but not a great difference. It basically probably would have been very similar.
See, and I think that's a really strong message that you have, is that time goes, 10, 20, 30, 50, 60 years go by, and it's still the same thing out there. It doesn't change.
No, it really doesn't. and it never will. There will always be a need for the type of thing I did, and there really won't be any change. It may be a little more sophisticated now than it was then, but basically it's the same black ops contractor does things that just aren't normally done.
Yeah. No, no. By the way, I hear you loud and clear. And back in 1966, 1960, right in that area, we had typewriters. We didn't have computers. We didn't have the sophisticated ability that we have today to communicate in seconds across the globe with pictures. That didn't exist. So that in and of itself, more sophisticated, obviously, it changes. Now, let's go back to, quote-unquote, the hero of the book. Is the hero of the book really, in real life, is it really you?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. It has to be, and that's a great thing. Now, what kind of experience does, quote-unquote, the hero have to have? What kind of training?
Well, there's a great deal of training, both mind and body. He has to be... have this mental and physical toughness, has to have great instincts. Preparation is just huge in the type of thing that I did. You have to know and study your target, and you have to be able to adapt on a dime. Those are the biggest things involved.
But then, is that trainable, Leo? When we really talk and think about that, there are a lot of things that we can train somebody to do. But that being adaptable, that fast, is that an innate talent or something automatic that somebody would have? Or can you really train somebody to think that fast?
No, you've either got it or you don't.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you've either got it or you don't. And, you know, you can't train instincts. They're either there or they're not there.
Yeah, and by the way, but the lead character is hiding the real job from the daughter, quote-unquote. That has got to be a tough thing to do when you've got a family and they think you're doing one thing, but you're truly doing something else. How do you live that double life?
Well, it was, I didn't find it all that difficult. You know, from the very beginning, I wasn't married in the beginning. And by the time I did get married, I was well established. And, you know, my cover stories was something, I did things that I had a great deal of knowledge about, and it was very easy. I mean, was it easy lying to your family? No, it wasn't, but it was the only thing you could do for both yourself, to protect yourself, and protect them. The only way someone could get to me was to get to my family through me, and, you know, that so that made it, the lying and the, you know, the storytelling, that made it easier. You had to protect your family. That was the number one thing.
Interesting point. As you're talking and thinking about this, the SEALs that took out bin Laden, for whatever reason, the information about who they were, et cetera, got out into public, and they were actually having to protect those SEALs from some kind of harm. Did you have those same kind of problems of exposure in today's world? You can't do anything. You can get sued for doing your job. You can get hung, quote unquote, for doing your job. Or everybody in the world knows who's doing the job, and that opens you up to all kinds of danger. Did you have that same exposure years back?
No, I absolutely had no exposure at all. Nobody knew what I did for over 30 years, and there was no exposure. I never once felt as though that I was in jeopardy or anybody in my family was in jeopardy.
Yeah, by the way, it could be an interesting point. You do the 30 years, you retire, you get into acting, get into producing, you get into the rest of it. How do you turn around and tell your family that, you know, the last 30 years, that's not who I was? That must have been tough.
It was a pretty interesting conversation.
Yeah.
I sat down and I told my mother and father were the first yeah. ones to know, and they were both very surprised, although after I told them, my father, things started to fall in place for him. He kind of, things sort of made sense. And then, you know, after that, you know, the people I told, a lot of people didn't know. I was remarried, and my current wife knew nothing about it. And little by little, I started telling people in my family, and then little by little, some of my friends. And most of them were just shocked. They had no clue.
Yeah, I mean, and when it really comes down to it, it would have to be an absolute shock. You think somebody is a certain person, and all of a sudden, they're completely different. There's more to them. There's more dynamic. There's more depth and strength and so on and so forth. So there's probably a bunch of people that you absolutely shocked when you told them, and you had to tell them to be able to do the book and do the things that you're doing now.
Well, a lot of them didn't find out until after the book came out.
Ah, okay. Oh, that's got to be interesting.
Yeah, it was. It was definitely interesting. I would run into people once the book came out, and they were just like, people that I've known almost all my life, and they were just totally blown away.
Yeah. Well, no, I can imagine, because all of a sudden they know this one persona, they know this one individual, and now that person is completely different. Now, let's talk about the book in and of itself, Termination Orders. What's the real takeaway in the book? Now, we don't want to give away the secrets because we can read the book, but what's the takeaway? I pick it up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I read the book?
Well, I would say that it just gives people insight to what really goes on with the government, how it's run, the people that run it, and really everything everybody thinks they know, they really know nothing about the real world. And I think that's what this book does. It gives a clearer view of what goes on, and where one of my favorite sayings is, where nothing is as it seems.
Yeah. Now, and by the way, whatever administration is running the government, it doesn't really matter. Are there black ops? Are there things that go on that the administration can't even know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's more often than not, they're clueless of what's going on. And without my saying a lot of other things that I'm not comfortable talking about, it's just that they don't, they really don't. And that's for several reasons. It's to protect them and also for deniability reasons. But I would say that mostly they don't know what's going on.
Okay, now would this be under military auspices? And I'm not going to ask for details. I'm not. That's not where I'm at with this. But who runs it? Is it the military or is it sub-military? Is it a group of people that are responsible for protecting us?
Can you be more specific? I'm not sure what you're asking.
If the administration and those kind of people don't know, who runs the operation? I don't mean a name, but what kind of an organization runs the operations?
Well, there are various clandestine agencies, throughout, not only in this country, throughout the world, and each one of them have their own little operations and, run their own operations. So, there's not just one, and it can be military, but it doesn't necessarily have to be military.
Okay, no, and I hear you with that. So there are organizations that, quote-unquote, keep the balance of power balanced in this world beyond the administration and beyond the things that we know. Which leads me to something else which I think is interesting. The torture today, okay? I'm old school. Leo, I'm old school, and I believe that if you're going to save, 150,000, 200,000 lives, then if somebody's going to get tortured, too bad. And whether people like it or not, that's my own experience of the way that I live and the way that I think. I'm an old former Marine, and there's certain ways you do things and certain ways you don't. But your take on not so much is torture good or bad, the reaction of administrations, of the public today, we're so sensitive that if you're responsible for garnering information that's going to save somebody, you have to be careful how you do it because you could end up going to jail.
Well, that's true, and I agree with you. I'm the old school. You do whatever it takes to get the job done. Period. End of sentence.
Yeah. No, I'm totally with you. June 21st, 1960, I was standing tall at MCRD and Marine Corps boot camp. You know, those were the old days when everybody was proud to be an American and so on and so forth. But I think the culture changed, the way we look at things have changed today, and we have to move in that with the culture, but there are certain things that have to stay constant. And I'm totally with you on that particular point. You do what you got to do to save lives, and that's what it's about. It's not about wanting to torture somebody. It's not about doing what you want to do. It's about the end result, the result and effect of what occurs once you do that.
No, that's 100% true. The main thing is to save as many lives as you can, and you do very simply. You just do what you have to do.
Yeah. No, loud and clear. Now, by the way, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, leojmaloney.com.
Okay, and now can we find the book there?
You will find the book there. It's also on Amazon, both paperback and Kindle, Borders, Barnes & Nobles, and it's also in the United Kingdom at this point in time on Amazon, and in also in a lot of local bookstores.
Yeah. By the way, one quick question. If you were going to handle that whole operation that took out bin Laden, would you have done it the same way, or would you have done it a little different?
You know what? I think that the planning of the military and the SEALs, I just can't give them enough kudos. I think they did a fantastic job, and I would never second-guess them. I just think the overall operation was great, and the SEALs deserve so much credit, and, they were just fantastic. So I would say, no, I myself wouldn't change anything. How can you ask for anything that was just short of perfection?
No, absolutely. By the way, I'm applauding, too. I think it worked. It worked well, and it was supposed to happen, and too bad it couldn't have happened before. But that really sent the message out that we're not going to sit back. Because if we're going to do something, we're going to find a way to do it, and that's the end of it. And, Leo, hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and I hope everybody is the book going to become a movie?
Well, we've been approached by it by a couple of different screenwriters who we're in negotiations with them. But right now we're mainly concentrating. This is going to be we're negotiating with a major publisher to make this a 5-book series, with Dan Morgan doing the entire, being the hero in the entire 5 books. So that's what's going on right now.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. Go get them. And what a wonderful background to do the book. My goodness.
And thank you very much for having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, good night.
Why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me the
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz with us, MD. He's the co-author of You're Not Your Brain, the four-step solution for changing bad habits, ending unhealthy thinking, and taking control of your life. He's a research psychiatrist at UCLA Medical School of Medicine, a seminal thinker, and a researcher in the field of self-directed neuroplasticity. He's the author of over 100 scientific publications in the field of neuroscience and psychiatry, and several popular books, including The Mind and the Brain, Neuroplasticity, and The Power of Mental Force. And let us say, Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. One of the things that I'm noticing over the years is more and more people are beginning to understand and realize the power of neuroscience. I meet you, I'm either going to get a shot of adrenaline or a shot of dopamine, one of the two, and based on that, it's going to cause my reactions and my behavior and do all kinds of things. And I am so thankful that the science behind it is starting to come to the fore.
Okay, it's interesting to hear you put it that way, because I mean, I'm all for neuroscience, right? I've been a member of the Society for Neuroscience since I was in my 20s. I'm about to turn 60. So I have spent my life in neuroscience, but the culture of neuroscience has gotten a little too mechanical, a little too, what the word I use is materialist, and you're quite right about the adrenaline, and you're quite right about the dopamine, but one of the things we like to be careful about, and it is a major part of the message of You Are Not Your Brain, is yes, those things do give you sort of an up, you do get an arousal. That's real. But you're much more than that. And you don't want to reduce your excitedness, your connectedness, your sense of anticipation, your sense of something great is about to happen, just, you know, to your norepinephrine, your noradrenaline, and sure, your dopamine and the other neurochemicals and hormones. So that stuff's important, but I feel that the culture has gotten a little too carried away with its explanatory power. There's a lot of really important aspects of human experience that go way beyond what those chemicals in your brain do. And that's a lot of why we call the book You Are Not Your Brain.
Okay, well, when you talk human experience, well, we talk about human experiences, some kind of an experience is going to cause a reaction. The reaction is going to cause a behavior. The behavior is going to be the result and effect of anything that you do in your life. So all of these things, and by the way, I'm not a proponent of any of it. I'm not a clinician, so we're just moving in conversation here. But all of those things.
I figure that. I mean, I kind of want to. I mean, I know you're a very open-minded man, and you know, I'm just trying to sort of put things in perspective. Because, I mean, one thing about me is, you know, I'm definitely doing this from the inside. I mean, I have spent my whole life in neuroscience, sure, and I'm happy to be a neuroscientist. Partly what I'm just trying to do is even get, you know, the people in neuroscience to just not think the brain is everything, and I'm sure that you don't think that.
No. And as a matter of fact, behavior in and of itself, you know, the four-step solution for changing bad habits. Habit is repetition of action. And once you do a little bit of a mind shift, which is not necessarily neuroscience, but it's thinking a little bit differently, you can begin to change things. If I look at the world differently, then my responses are going to be different.
Thank you very much. There's my entry, because that's exactly what it's that relationship between mind, and I use the word mind specifically to mean the choices you make about how you focus your attention.
Yeah.
Because my whole career of over 30 years has been about how the choices that people make about how they focus their attention can change their brain. Now, if you don't make those choices, if the repetition that you just mentioned is all brain-driven, and without making choices, it will largely be brain-driven. So the brain can control your entire life if you let it. And the problem with that is a lot of our brain has been wired in from our early experiences, family, etc., as well as the very large part of our feeling states that are driven by the animal aspects of our brain, because the vast majority of the neural mechanisms of the brain structures that we have are in common with the animal world. So a lot of our ways of responding to experience have a lot of similarities to other animals. But we don't want our lives to just be animal lives. And so the choices that you make about the feelings that you get, and specifically in the book, we speak about deceptive brain messages, because a lot of us, all of us, there are no exceptions. All of us have had experiences in our lives which have, you know, left their mark, which gets us directed in ways that hold our attention and push us in ways that are not really where we want to go. You know, nobody's perfect. Nobody is you know, on goal all the time. And a lot of that has to do with brain messages that have been wired in from largely from our younger parts of our lives, when we weren't aware, or because we haven't really had training in awareness yet. But the big message is that with awareness and what we call the wise advocate, which is the part of yourself that we all have that can make choices about the alignment between what you're doing, where your feelings are taking you, and what your goals are. So a big part of what we call the wise advocate is it's a very supportive part of yourself. It's an inner part of yourself that is very connected, very loving, very supportive, but it also is very potent in terms of focusing attention and making choices. And we really want to be asking ourselves the question, is what I'm doing right now, are the behaviors that I'm repeating, are they just the result of the habit center of my brain? Because the habit center of our brains is very, very powerful. I mean, it's something that we share with rodents. I mean, the habit center of our brain is not significantly different than the habit center of a rat. So we have this very powerful, deep part of our brain that does get wired with habits, and those habits can become completely unaware. We can be completely unaware of them. So we want to rise above that and use our wise advocate and use our observational power, which is sometimes in the book and in other places now commonly called mindfulness or mindful awareness, to be able to ask ourselves, is this habit that I'm doing right now, is this repeated behavior that I'm doing right now, is it going where I want to go? Is it getting me in the direction that I really want to end up? And then we start to make assessments. And the powerful part of the message is through the assessments that we make, and there is a part of your brain that we call the assessment center, which is the most evolutionarily advanced part of our brain. And those assessments allow us to change those habits, change the wiring, change deep wiring that we're not even aware is controlling our lives. And the key is using our wise advocate to see what we're doing, see where we're going, and then make choices about how we focus our attention to change our brains.
Okay, let's touch on something. Three words. One was brain messages, and the other one was perfection. The brain messages for most people are that your perfection has got to do with somebody else's definition of what perfection is. And I can see that if you make the assessment, you'll begin to realize that who you are is not who somebody else thinks you are, that you are trying to be like.
Excellent summary. That point is one of the main points in You Are Not Your Brain. In fact, we go to that again and again and again, because there are numerous stories in the book, narratives about people, and perhaps the most common way they get off track, perhaps the most common way that they lose connection with their wise advocate and let their habit center and their animal brain run their lives is exactly what you just said. They allow essentially behaviorist type reward mechanisms that other people are providing to wire their brains for them. And of course, a lot of this happens when you're younger, before you're even aware. And one of the main things that you need to use your wise advocate to do is to ask yourself the question, am I doing this because I think it's in my genuine best interest, in the genuine best interest of the people that I love, in the genuine best interest of the community that I'm trying to support, or am I just acting based on basically conditioning that I have gone through in my past, that when I was doing things to make people whose values I don't share like me? And there's a lot of that that goes on in the world, and our wise advocate is how we can rise above that. And that kind of repeated behavior from the past can be rewired in ways that are very adaptive. And that's the big message of the book.
Yeah, the wise advocate obviously has got to come from that conscious part of your mind for your thinking, your reasoning, the decision making. But there's also something else that falls into play. And if you go back to who was it, the DiMaggio out of University of Southern California in the early the middle 90s, the somatic marker hypothesis that he developed. Unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience triggering a reaction, good or bad, in the moment that you're seeing something, watching something, they're not doing it, you are. And I believe...
I'm at UCLA, so I mean, I'm more than happy to talk about Tony DiMaggio. He's a little bit of a crosstown rival, but it's a lot more than that. I mean, there are many people here at UCLA who like Tony DiMaggio. I think Tony DiMaggio is a good scientist, and we've had different perspectives on this for a long, long time. I agree with what you just gave as a description of the somatic marker hypothesis as far as it goes, and I think it's a credit to Tony DiMaggio and the quality of his science that the somatic marker hypothesis, as you very eloquently described it right there and accurately, it's true, but. My difference in perspective with Tony DiMaggio comes at the point of what do you do about it? I mean, Tony DiMaggio has made the case of Phineas Gage very, very famous, and you probably know, given such a good description you just gave of the somatic marker hypothesis. Phineas Gage is a workman in the 19th century who had essentially a crowbar, you know, blown up through his skull by a little piece of dynamite that he was working with as I think he was working on train tracks at the time, and it left a hole in his brain, in a very key part of his brain, a part of the brain that both DiMaggio and I have studied at great length over decades, called the orbitofrontal cortex. And the orbitofrontal cortex has complete agreement, there's complete agreement in the neuroscience community about this. We're all completely on the same page that the orbitofrontal cortex, which is the bottom of the front of the brain, sits right over the eye sockets or eye orbits, that's how it gets its name, is very, very important in moral thinking, in our value systems. And DiMaggio has made this, you know, very well documented case of this man, Phineas Gage, and the fact that after he had damage to that area of his brain, a formerly upstanding moral citizen became, you know, a less than upstanding, less than moral citizen, and it's explained in terms of this brain injury. Well and good. I mean, to that point, there's no disagreement. But the thing that's really important to me, that I feel that those who sort of stop at the somatic marker, stop at the brain explanations, just will not get past, is that same area of the brain is an area of the brain that people who have obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a condition that I've been studying for over 30 years, and most of my academic research has been on that subject, and that's why I've studied that area of the brain so closely. That area of the brain is also not working right in people with obsessive compulsive disorder. And the big message is that when you have people with obsessive compulsive disorder who, and now we're in the 21st century, we're not in the 19th century anymore, and we have had advances using brain imaging that show that when you can teach people, look, that is your brain sending you a false message. That's not really you. That's not the true you. That is a deceptive brain message. You don't have to listen to that. That kind of training, this is really how I made my reputation in psychiatry and neuroscience, that kind of training changes the wiring in this very area, the orbitofrontal cortex, that was the source of Phineas Gage's problem. So, you know, that was the 19th century. This is the 21st century. So we can do better than that now, and we can do better than that with training and with focused attention. We don't have to stop at our brain sends us a somatic marker and we respond to it. We can do better than that.
Now, by the way, let me take it the next step from the somatic marker, which was obviously a hypothesis. Let me put in this into language everybody will understand. I was eight and a half years old. I'm standing in front of the mirror, got my cowboy hat on, cap guns. I'm screaming and yelling, and I'm playing cowboys, and I'm having the greatest time in the world. My dad walked in, and he laughed at me and shut me right off. Now, as an eight-year-old, I played in front of the mirror again, but I never did it again out loud. As an adult, I truly understand what occurred. and I'm fine. But as a teenager, you didn't dare laugh at me. You didn't dare talk down to me. Unconscious activation of a memory to a recognized.
What a wonderful example. What a wonderful example. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Look how your awareness, you matured, your mind matured, your brain matured. You had an experience. That experience of humiliation in light of your dad, I'm sure he was, you know, completely unaware of the emotional response that this caused in you. It's not the parents' fault, you know, 99.9%. I mean, this is life. These are the things that happen to everyone in life. And you have just given such a good example of, in adolescence, you had this huge sensitivity because you didn't realize your brain had become wired through this experience. You didn't realize what had happened. You were a slave to deceptive brain messages telling you that you were less than, telling you that you were humiliated, telling you that if anyone laughed at you, that was, you know, an emotional trauma. Now, an adult with a wise advocate says, wait a second, I don't have to respond like that. This is not me. I don't have to be that. I can be better than that. I can understand things more deeply than that. And when you refocus your attention with that new psychological insight, you can rewire that circuitry. Beautiful example.
Yeah, no question. And I really believe that that's it. That's the comment to say what you were talking about is to bridge to get you to some kind of homeostasis, to some kind of balance in your life.
New homeostasis. Amen. Yeah. That's what we're looking for. That is what we're all looking for, a new, more adaptive homeostasis, which is a balance. So we create a new balance in our brain. And that's, you know, you quoted that term that I coined years ago. My last book, The Mind and the Brain, goes into great detail about self-directed neuroplasticity. You can direct your attention to change your brain. That's just fancy wording. That's what self-directed neuroplasticity means. You can direct your attention to change your brain, and when you do that, you create a new homeostasis. Homeostasis really just means a new balance. And things were out of balance before because of the experiences that we had, because of the way we responded to those experiences. And now, with the power of focused attention, we create a new homeostasis. And when we do that, we change that brain wiring. And we now have our brain working with us, for us, going us in the direction we want to go, the direction our true self wants to pursue. Our brain is no longer working against us. Now, through focused attention and the power of our wise advocate to make wiser choices, we create a new homeostasis, and our brain works for us, not against us.
Jeffrey, let me say that. We're starting to run out of time, but let me say that in a different way. You and I are standing in the room, and you're standing with your feet together, ankles together, standing very stiff with your hands along the sides of your legs. You're very stiff. I'm in front of you, and I push you with a certain amount of pressure. You fall back. Now, we get into the same situation, but this time your legs are apart. You got your balance, and I push you with the same pressure. You don't fall. So the message here is that everything is the same, but you shifted, so now it's all different.
You're very, very good. I got to take you out on the road with me. That's a very, very good example. I mean, exactly. And all I want to do now is take that example, which you used in terms of physical and obviously martial arts, you know, wonderful, you know, very good principles of martial arts you just elucidated. I want us to use our brain exactly that way. So your brain becomes the thing that doesn't get pushed over by a certain amount of pressure. As you know, you as an adolescent, you know, you had an emotional trauma. You weren't well balanced. The push moved you. You rebalanced yourself. You rebalanced your brain chemistry by rebalancing yourself. Now the same push is easy to fend off. The same push is easy to adapt to. The same push is easy to put you into a new, well-balanced position that allows you to make choices about what to do about it.
Absolutely. Now, we're running out of time. Jeffrey, do you have a website we can find you at and buy the books?
Absolutely. I have two websites. YouAreNotYourBrain.com. Obviously, one word, YouAreNotYourBrain.com. And then my personal website, which has a lot of video and audio on it, is Jeffrey, JeffreyM. Schwartz, SCHWARTZ.com. So youarenotyourbrain.com, jeffreymschwartz.com.
Hey, Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated every minute you spent with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you. That was excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.
Night.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you with a love oh so true?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sylvia Bauer coming up next.
Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do.
Sylvia Bauer with us. She's her RN, and she lives with celiac disease and has been a practicing nurse for 43 years now. She's been an active participant in the gluten-free gang, is a member of the Ohio Nurses Association, and is a frequent presenter at the National Annual Celiac Conference. Her latest book, What Nurses Know, Gluten-Free Living, it's full of current and essential information on gluten issues. And let us say, Sylvia, I welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there's so much about gluten that we hear constantly, but let's start with laying a base of what we're talking about. Let's start out with celiac disease. What is that?
Okay.
What
do we deal with? Celiac disease is an autoimmune disease that is created and triggered by the body's reaction to the protein in wheat, barley, and rye.
Oh, okay. Now,
three
body
aspects
reaction
to that. Excuse me?
Okay, but let's go slow so we can get all the points. The body's reaction.
Okay.
What kind of reaction can the body have?
The interesting thing is there's different reactions. Some people react to it with gastrointestinal symptoms such as severe diarrhea, constipation, bloating, anemia because they're not absorbing nutrients, joint pain, and it can even settle in the cerebrospinal or the neuro system, which causes unbalance of walking. And there's frequent people that women who have infertility problems because of the presence of gluten in their bodies.
So if we look at some of these symptoms, that could tell us that we have a gluten intolerance. And if we know what it is, then we can... Is it nutrition that's really the key here to fix things?
The only treatment is... If there was a pill, everybody know about it. But the only treatment is staying on a gluten-free diet.
Okay, now, what are we talking about when we talk gluten-free diet?
Gluten is the proteins that are found in the wheat, barley, and rye. And the thing that we most frequently see, of course, is wheat and now that is considered an allergen by the FDA, so it must be on a label. But it's the protein in those grains that actually cause destruction to the small intestine and create the symptoms that occur.
Now, by the way, if I get the symptoms, I go to the doctor's office, how do they diagnose that that's what it is? What kind of testing do we have to have?
There's a very simple lab test now called tissue transglutaminase test. There's a few others that they can run, but that is about 95 to 98% specific. And if you are eating gluten, those antibodies will show up. If you stop eating gluten and a few months later try to be tested, it's not going to show up.
Okay, now there's a difference between celiac disease, gluten intolerance, and gluten allergy. What's the difference between the three?
Yes, there is.
And how am I going to tell the difference if I'm starting to get symptoms?
Well, the best thing to do is to immediately be tested, because if you have the symptoms, then it's going to be in its immediate phase and the antibodies will show up. The difference, celiac disease actually has a destruction in the small intestine. It's an inflammatory process. Gluten intolerance, you can have symptoms such as bloating, diarrhea, constipation, but you don't have the antibodies show up like you do in celiac disease. For the gluten allergy, it's much more of an allergic reaction, such as itching, hives, symptoms that you would normally get with any other kind of an allergy, and you do not have the antibodies for that either.
Okay, now, we've heard... Oh, go ahead.
Well, it's the antibodies that show up for the celiac disease. That is the main way that you can tell the difference between the three.
Now, there's a word, there's a term that we keep hearing over and over and over again, and that term is autoimmune disease. What are we dealing with? What's a practical way of looking at this so the layman knows?
When you have an autoimmune disease, your body is actually creating antibodies against whatever it considers to be either a foreign object, a foreign body, or a foreign substance. And in this case, the foreign substance that your body is reacting against are the proteins to those three grains. And it opens up some, like a little locks in your small intestine, and the protein is large enough to go through those locks and can really go to any part of your system and really can cause a lot of systemic damage. If a child has celiac disease and they are eating gluten, their intestine locks are open and those things go through. They're not absorbing nutrients. They're not absorbing their calcium and their protein and all of the things that a child needs to grow. So therefore, they may have a growth problem and they just stop growing at a certain age.
Okay, so realistically, what we're saying is, and stop me if I'm wrong here, I'm not a clinician, but what we're saying is based on gluten, if you have an intolerance to gluten and you eat certain things that are gluten, that have gluten in them or comprised of gluten, that it can stop some of the chemicals to go to the different processes of your body and it can start some real problems for you.
That's right, systemic problems. It's not just an intestinal problem. It can go throughout the body. It can go to joints. It can go to the central nervous system. It can go cause infertility. It can cause anemia because you're not absorbing any iron. You're not absorbing calcium, so your bones can get very weak, get osteoporosis.
So
that's
if you
why
don't
I say systemic, because it can affect so many things.
So if you don't catch it in time, if you don't recognize the system or the symptoms in your children and your spouse and whatever the case may be, this can lead to some, I would venture to guess, and again, stop me if I'm wrong, some life-threatening events.
Very life-threatening, that's true. If you do not stay on a gluten-free diet and you do have celiac disease, you're very high risk for three different kinds of cancer. Because your body, the autoimmune reaction in your body is causing your body to put out T cells. And T cells are the causative factor usually for lymphoma. And to me, it was certainly a no-brainer to stay on a gluten-free diet because I don't think any of us want to be high risk for three different kinds of cancer.
No, but before you were a nurse, when you realized that you had this, what were some, and how long have you had it?
I've had it for 14 years.
Okay, so you were a nurse when, okay.
I was a practicing nurse when I got it. I felt very, very ill. I knew something was wrong. My doctor thought that I probably had cancer. He couldn't prove it, but because my blood count was going down and down and down, he said, I think that you're bleeding, and I wasn't. But you just feel bad all over because you're not absorbing any nutrients. It was very sudden. Fortunately, I was diagnosed in about 3 or 4 months. Many, many people take 10 to 15 years to be diagnosed, which means that they're going from doctor to doctor and just very frustrated because they don't know what's the matter.
And the doctor doesn't know what to look for.
Not able to find an answer.
Now, by the way, 14 years ago, were they as sophisticated as they are today in delving into this particular topic? Did they know more today than they knew 14 years ago? And the reason I'm saying that is, even today, from what you're saying, the diagnosis might be a tough thing, and if you're not going to a specialist, they may never find out what's going on. And 14 years ago, it had to be even worse than that.
It was much, much worse. There were very, very few designated gluten-free food items, for one thing. The other thing is there were very few physicians who really knew about it. And if they did know about it, they weren't real sure what to do about it. But it's pretty easy for a doctor to say, you probably have celiac disease. We've done some biopsies, which is the way it's diagnosed. When they do an endoscopy, they put a tube down into the stomach, into the small intestine, and take some biopsies, and that is the gold standard of diagnosing. But there was so little follow-up. There was so little education available, which it prompted me to write a book because I was researching, and I thought, if I can't find anything about it as a nurse, then there's a lot of people that don't know about it, you know?
Yeah. Sylvia,
I researched the research.
No, we're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. I have an email address, and I would be more than happy to share it with your listeners because am glad to answer any questions. You know, the reason the book was written was to try to meet the needs of the educational aspects of people that have been sick and don't know what's the matter and suspect that they may have it. The prevalence studies show, they have done prevalence studies, and 1 out of 133 people in the United States do have it just by the blood testing that's been done randomly.
So Sylvia, hold up. Wait,
means there's 3 million of us.
Sylvia, I know we're running out of time, so if you could give us the email address, that would be great.
Okay. It's SBOWER5559@AOL.com.
Wonderful. By the way, if anybody misses it, it'll be up on our website for people to see. Sylvia Bauer, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure, and I'll look forward to answering any questions anyone has.
Wonderful. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your tears and laughter
dusty walls. People say you